Folks, welcome to Pod X Medicine, the official podcast of the Academy of Extreme Environment Medicine. I am your host, Sunny, and I've got the wonderful Bridgie with me today. Bridgie, how are you?
I'm really good, thanks, Sonny. I'm excited for this one. It's
You good?
definitely about something that I've got no idea about.
That's the best kinds of conversations we have because it is where we learn the most. You are comfortable, you've stuck a pillow on your chair, you've got a new microphone, and you're ready to go.
It's still making sound, but I've got a new mic. I'm a new woman. New mic, new me.
Hey, today we've got the wonderful Dr. Alicia Tucker with us. Alicia, how are you?
Good, thank you, Sonny. Very pleased to meet Bridgie as well.
Hey, listen, the names trap us a lot. Now, if I read your name, it would be Alicia.
Yes,
Am
no,
I
Alicia is correct.
Alicia is correct. So I'm not going to get slapped today, Bridgie. I was all over it.
Oh,
We need
sweet.
We're going to clarify a couple of these things because Bridget and I are actually talking about them. But thank you so much for being with us today. Hey, what do you do?
What do I do? I
What
kind
do you
of,
do?
it's a bit like what don't I do? I suppose by primary profession, I'm an emergency physician. And so I work in a tertiary referral centre, but I got to that qualification in a more alternate route, in the sense that I started out as a surgical trainee. I was going to be a urologist, God forbid. And then when I changed to the dark side of emergency medicine, I ended up doing a lot of my training in rural and remote areas. So, philosophy, go and work where other people go on holidays. So you get to pay, get paid to live and play. So that introduced me to like-minded people. I worked in the outback, Alice Springs, and in coastal and inland New South Wales, and also in Queensland. And I'm from Tasmania, so I've kind of been fortunate to be able to meet like-minded people that propelled me into things like wilderness and extreme environment medicine. And that has led me on a route that now takes me as a diving and hyperbaric specialist, as well as a aerospace medicine physician.
Now, it's kind of like what hat do you wear at what time? You are literally one of the busiest people that I've ever met. The time in New South Wales and Queensland, was that part of RFDS? Were you flying during those?
So I was RFDS in Alice Springs. So that was based in Alice Springs, doing primary and inter-hospital retrievals between pretty much the far, just on the other side of the Western Australian border, as to the Queensland border, up as far as a place called Elliot in the NT, which is kind of part of the way between Tennant Creek and Darwin. And then as far south as kind of Coober Pedy, but we used to fly down to Adelaide, which was our tertiary referral centre for people who are particularly sick, particularly kids and interventional cardiology.
From
That's quite
Alice
a flight.
Springs, Alice Springs to Coober Pedy to Queensland and New South Wales. I mean, you're flying everywhere.
Yeah.
What is it about a confined space or a confined metal object that you can't stand up in that attracted you to this kind of speciality of emergency medicine? There's nothing comfortable here. Like, it's good. I
No.
mean, you've done some travel, but it's a tiny aircraft.
Yes. Well, I mean, I suppose the thing is that you want to try and get from A to B as quickly as possible. I think that the thing that attracts me just about extreme environment medicine in general is kind of people don't just live on the eastern seaboard in the big cities. And so you've got individuals who have got primary health problems as well as acute illness and injury. And they deserve just as much access to healthcare as the rest of us. Sometimes we have to then use whatever means possible in order to be able to deliver healthcare. So whether that's outreach clinics or whether that's jumping in a helicopter if it's nice and close range, or in the old aluminium cigar to go and pick up people from left, right, and centre. I suppose there's always a challenge with whatever type of retrieval transport that you use, whether or not it's an ambulance or the back of a ute. or an actual equipment filled flying ICU, as in like an RFDS fixed wing aircraft. So they all have their own little challenges, but I think that for me, that is what is the beauty of extreme environment medicine. You have to kind of work with what you've got, make sure that you have a good understanding of where you're going, what you're doing, be really flexible, and have a bit of a MacGyver instinct so that you can be adaptable. You can't be just dependent on nurses must do the observations and put up the IV fluids and all of those kind of stereotypes that sort of tend to be more rigidly played out within a tertiary referral centre. So, yeah, no. So fixed wing aircraft are actually a lot more palatable than helicopters, I must say. I'm not a big fan of
Oh,
helicopters.
that's controversial.
I know, I know. Like I enjoy the. I did some Westpac rescue stuff out of Tamworth, but my probably my my slight trepidation when it comes to rotary wing aircraft probably is played out by the fact that one of the consultants in Tamworth actually was involved in a helicopter going down with a patient and the pilot. So they were fine, but it just, I suppose it's
Yeah,
like
they
anything,
were
it
fine.
frames, they were fine. It just frames your own kind of level of desire to be a helicopter cowboy versus someone
Oh,
who's
come on. Have you ever seen a car crash? It doesn't mean you don't want to drive a car. I mean, when I see clinicians stepping out of an aircraft, that's the tin cigar. I mean, they seem to step out fairly normally, and let me just offend every single helicopter rescue paramedic in the country. I've also worked in helicopters, and I did this, but when you step out of a helicopter,
Oh, there's
you
a swagger.
strut. Oh, there's a
Yeah,
swagger.
there's a swagger.
Not when you step out of a
Okay.
plane, it's the helicopter.
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly, as I said, helicopter cowboys. I was one of those once, but now I've got kids. I'm less enamored of
Left
it.
that behind.
Yeah, I've left that behind. Well, at the same time, I'd be very happy to go up in a rocket, which is probably, more dangerous.
It's almost evolved. It's evolved from helicopter cowboy to Rocket Man.
Cue the song.
Are you going to sing for us, Sonny?
Going to be inspired.
I think we need to rewrite it, Rocket Woman. Hey, let's talk about this really quickly because I mean, there's some stuff that I want to circle back to, because again, your experiences are just so varied and far between. But a major part of what you do now through the dive and hypomeric medicine space and the center that you work in Tassie, is actually revolving around space medicine, and you've actually had some reasonably interesting experiences, even recently. Hey, Bridgie, where was she? What were you reading recently?
I'm going to say it wrong, but is it Lunares in Poland?
Yeah, Lunaris. Yeah,
Yeah,
so.
I was definitely giving you a bit of a stalk. Commander.
Oh, yes, Commander. Yes. Yeah, no. So my kind of everyday job, I suppose you could say, I'm half time in the emergency department at the Royal Hobart. And that's a, major referral centre, big trauma centre. And then I do point two in the diving and hyperbaric unit. And then I'm point one with the UTAS Healthcare Remote and Extreme Environments as a senior lecturer in space medicine. So all of these are kind of amalgamated with my various other hats, which are personal play hats as well as professional play hats. And so I got into space medicine probably around about 10 years ago, where I was doing some CPD scouting. I would been kind of a MUM and a DMT for emergency medicine. And then it came up with the Live Like an Astronaut on Mars Learning Aerospace Medicine with the Wilderness Medicine Society. I was like, and I had, well, what, 2-year-old and a 4-year-old at the time. And I showed my phone to my husband, and he's like, oh God, you want to go and do that, don't you? So that was kind of my first little, I've kind of gone and worked or played in a lot of extreme environments. I've been to every continent. I've done polar ships, physician work, and as well as outback and remote desert, etc. But space just really intrigued me as the kind of the ultimate extreme environment. So I was fortunate to do the Mars Desert Research Station a couple of weeks with, there were six of us, and then three NASA flight surgeons. So we learned all about aerospace medicine and did EVAs, which are like spacewalks, a couple of times a day, where we had objectives and we had different roles, and we had to really work together with having a really low-resourced facility. And then that really kind of made me go, wow, you know, space is unlike anything. And that really made me kind of go, what can I do in order to be able to do more of this kind of space medicine? I mean, it's super cool. So I did kind of aerospace. I did the basic and advanced humans in space course. We don't really have any other formal, well, at the time, we didn't have even HREE, so we didn't have the space medicine unit that I could indulge in. And I ended up doing an aviation, a certificate of civil aviation medicine through Monash, became a designated aviation medical examiner, went to Houston and undertook some training with what's called the Principles of Aviation and Space Medicine with the University of Texas Medical Branch. And then I saw the Neutral Buoyancy Lab, which is where they have the big mock-up of the space station in that sort of life-size mock-up in the big swimming pool there. And that made me realize that kind of marriage between hyperbaric and space. And so the following year, I ended up doing a fellow year at the Royal. I'm getting on to Poland, but it kind of, what it did is it made me realize that although I couldn't train necessarily as a flight surgeon, which is like a doctor to astronauts, because I don't have American citizenship and we don't have a formal training
Boo.
program here, it meant that I could do clinical medicine and get paid to be a diving hyperbaric physician, whilst also having that ability to indulge in its association with space medicine, which kind of leads us to the hyperbaric facility that we have at the Royal, which you alluded to earlier. So we have a dual capable chamber, the only one in the Southern Hemisphere,
Wow.
and
What
we
does that
can.
mean just for people?
So it means that it is able to be hyperbaric or pressurized to a depth equivalent of 50 meters of seawater, and it can also fly or be called hypobaric. And it's human rated to 45,000 feet on positive pressure oxygen, and we can experimentally fly it up to nearly 100,000 feet. So
How big is it?
it's the actual size of it, gosh, I haven't even really thought about the square meters of it. So there are three
I'm more
blocks.
concerned if you can stand up in it.
Oh, 100%. So there are three compartments to it, or three locks.
Wow.
And all of them are, it's like walking into a normal room. So, unlike a lot of people think of dive chambers as being these pokey little, either like
Like a tank.
the little tanks, yeah, like what you saw, you know, Michael Jackson used to sleep in a hyperbaric chamber.
I didn't see that, but the ones that I've seen myself have been little tiny tanks, and you kind
Yeah.
of squeeze in and read a
And you kind
book
of go,
and
oh.
yeah.
And then there are multi-place chambers, which are typically can be anything from a deck chamber, so like more like a cylinder, like a pill shape. And then the more modern chambers, particularly one designed and built by Finke Engineering, which is a Queensland-based chamber engineering company. And they've built quite a lot of the chamber facilities, or the chambers for facilities around Australia, and ours is one of theirs. But what makes it unique is the, in order to make a chamber into a hyperbaric environment, you use compressors and you just essentially fill the chamber with compressed air, which increases the ambient pressure and gives you a comparative increase of one atmosphere of pressure every 10 meters equivalent of sea level. And whereas with the hypobaric side of things, we've got these little doors on the outside and we have these amazing vac pumps. We've got six of them that essentially suck the molecules out of the chamber. And that is how you reduce the environment and essentially fly. So
Wow.
no changing of the movement. There is no water in the hyperbaric side, and there is no flying literally in the hypo side. So it allows us to be able to we deliver day-to-day hyperbaric treatments as our main clinical role, but then we've got this facility to be able to do hypobaric research, which can be from aviation or aviation retrieval through to space medicine.
Clinically, with the hyperbaric chamber, what would you say is the most common presentation that you guys are treating on a day-to-day basis?
So on a day-to-day basis, we actually most of the what we call routine treatments. So every day we have two or three treatment sessions, up to six people per session. And most of our patients actually have soft tissue radiation injury. So when people have radiation therapy for cancer treatments, the type of radiation technology that we have nowadays is very targeted. However, you have the potential to have some radiation exposure to cells that are outside of the cancer. Yeah, you might have to travel through it, or they might just be very closely associated. So when we treat someone with radiation, what we're trying to do is to be able to target rapidly turning over DNA and either destroy it or reduce its ability to be able to replicate, and therefore it kind of hopefully will either shrink or get rid of the cancer. Our naturally regularly turning over cells, things like our skin cells, cells lining the bladder, bowel, the lining of the mouth, all those sorts of things, they are also potentially injured during that process. However, unlike dysplastic or cancer cells, they have the ability to be able to self-repair. So hopefully, if they don't get hit with too much radiation, aka like a nuclear bomb or whatever, if they have the ability to be able to recover, then they will repair. However, what tends to happen with radiation, particularly very high doses of radiation, is that the cells have recovered, but they kind of still have very significant vulnerability. So it only takes one additional insult for those cells to kind of break down and for fibrosis to set in and for healing to be a problem. So typically, what we tend to see is people who've got things like radiation cystitis, proctitis, so injury to the bladder or bowel, particularly in the context of prostate cancer treatment. And people come in with, bleeding and pain, and not everyone who gets radiation will experience this, but it might be something as simple as a UTI or a really bad bowel infection that suddenly means that those mucosal cells just give up the ghost and they just slough away. So hyperbaric, without necessarily going into all the nuances, essentially there are kind of three pillars for hyperbaric. One is using those pressure changes that we take someone from sea level down to treatment pressure, whatever that is. And what that does is any gas that is in an enclosed space, so particularly gas bubbles filled with nitrogen for a diver that's had decompression sickness, the higher pressure helps to make the bubbles get smaller. Then we can slowly get the bubbles out of the system. Otherwise, the high level of breathing 100% oxygen in a compressed gas kind of way, so in a high pressure environment, what that does is it maximizes how much oxygen is carried around on your hemoglobin mo molecules. However, what it does is it does this kind of soda stream effect, which it actually dissolves By Henry's law, it actually dissolves the oxygen into your plasma. So your plasma is then kind of like this really rich font of oxygen that can then passively go to wherever it needs to go. So preferentially to low oxygen or hypoxic tissues. And by exposing the body to those periods of hyperbaric treatment, that then normalizes oxygen levels for the struggling cells and makes them more active. However, if you have a course of it, what it does is by having periods where you have high oxygen and then you're not having oxygen because you're outside the chamber, what it does is your body kind of goes, oh, I actually like that. I like it when I've got oxygen because everything kind of fits and works. So how can I get oxygen to these kind of starved, hypoxic places? So most of the radiation, or even people who've got microvascular disease from diabetes, what happens is they're just hypovascular, so they don't have any blood vessels, they're hypoxic, and therefore they won't be able to heal. But by doing this kind of on-off effect, you actually get stem cell migration to where it's needed, and you get neovascularization or formation of new blood vessels. So it doesn't happen overnight, but most of our treatments are kind of up to say 30 to 40 treatments, so 2 hour treatment daily for a 6 to 8 week period. And what that does is it helps to reinvigorate, revascularize, and therefore reoxygenate areas to provide long-term healing to the areas that were previously affected by radiation. So there you go. And so that's what we mostly do. We do treat divers, obviously. We have probably by absolute numbers, we treat the most in Australia, which is,
What? The cold water?
I know
You have
exactly.
more divers
Who's
being
diving
treated.
down there? Exactly. But you kind of go, like certainly Townsville and Fremantle, they both get quite a number. But even if you have a look at compared to the population, the number of divers that we treat is absolutely disproportionate to the other states. But we're an island. We have a considerable commercial dive industry with salmon, abalone, sea urchin clearing up. We have hydro dam divers. We have police divers. And we also have the only current only saturation diver training facility in the world at Lake Sathana, which is near Cradle Mountain. So we have all of these commercial people, as well as the fact that we have a considerable recreational diving community, many of whom are not necessarily paddy trained or the like, many of whom don't use scuba. They use surface supply, breathing apparatus, or what's called hooker. And many of those hookers are not necessarily well maintained, or really truly understood. And many Tasmanians, they actually estimated something between like 20 or 30,000 recreational divers in Tasmania, which is not bad out of a population of about sort of 650,000.
Yeah,
However,
you're up
most of
the
those
tide.
people would just be like, oh, you're 18 now, get yourself a scallop license, breathe on this, go down, get your 50 scallops, and so we do see people who run into problems because they don't dive with dive computers. They haven't got prior training to be able to say, look, if you run out of air in the bottom, don't hold your breath and swim to the surface. You've got to breathe out because otherwise your lungs will expand. So we do unfortunately see a couple of deaths per year in Tasmania.
There's some cheeky Queenslanders listening to this going, maybe Tassie should learn how to dive. But
Yeah, no,
I've got a genuine question
100%.
though, is in a lot of the experiences that I've got, because I've done a lot of diving on film sets and documentaries all around the world. It's been a wonderful couple of decades. But majority of the incidents or majority of the accidents that I've certainly had to manage have actually been in cold water places. So my question to you is why? Why would we get more incidents in cold water than warm, or is that just a coincidence?
Well, I suppose just in terms of with regards to the type of diving that you're doing, Generally, in colder places, you may have less predictable conditions. So you might have a lot more surge, poorer visibility, and therefore you may have to be working harder, which is increasing your circulation through your muscles and all that kind of stuff. And so therefore potentially is going to be providing more opportunity for translation of nitrogen into your tissues. And then equally, particularly while you're going through decompression, when you're cold, you vasoconstrict. So that'll actually reduce your ability to be able to decompress in the same way as you would be if you were in a much more warmer environment. So hence the reason why we say things like you should wear dry suits and the like, so that you don't have that real bitter cold with the vasoconstriction. And so probably your observations are correct. The other thing about diving in cold places is what people tend to do is they're so fucking cold that they get out of the water, they quickly kind of put all their stuff aside, and then they jump in the hot shower. And
Yes.
so by
Okay.
doing that, what they are doing is they're essentially, if they just start effervescing, so they start vasodilating, and all of these bubbles start coming out of the tissues, and now they're at sea level pressure. So those bubbles will start coming out, and they'll get stuck because they'll expand within the area
But how
of
good is a
which they're
hot
kind of
shower?
evolved.
Come
Oh,
on.
100%, 100%. But
Come out of 6 degree water.
the number of times we see people where it's kind of like, oh yeah, no, and then I came out and I had a shower, and then all of a sudden I started feeling tingly, and it's
My
like,
joints were really hurting.
and my joints are really sore, and so I had more of a shower. Yeah, okay, all right. So yeah, so some good observations, but some good physiology to kind of back it up.
I find this interesting because when, Bridgie first asked you about the chamber, I'm sure a lot of people's natural expectations was that you'd be talking about dive-related incidents. And what you actually did was you took us a totally different direction to where even I thought we were going to go. And it blows my mind because there's so much overlap, like you said, between dive hyperbaric and things like space medicine. And, I hear people sometimes saying, space exploration's a waste of money. We should invest in things here on Earth. And I think there's so many things that have come from space medicine, like even something as simple as a phone camera. We wouldn't have them on our phones unless we had people in space who required much smaller cameras. We wouldn't have scratch-resistant glasses or lenses. We wouldn't even have a CT scanner. And my favorite's the microwave. Like we've got no patience these days. Thank God a microwave was invented to heat food up,
Exactly.
in
Well,
these places.
without satellites and without things being blasted into space, that is just from a technology perspective, we wouldn't have GPS, we wouldn't have our phones. Most people interact with space most of the day, and they don't necessarily realize it. Here we are being able to be bounced from A to B to C. And look, I remember as a kid being on the phone to the UK to family over in the UK, and you have to stop, you have to phone the operator, and then you had to be put through, and then you had to not stop the setup. But yeah, so it was, the fact that we can have vision and we can do all of this is one thing. But I think in terms of terrestrial applications for kind of from a space and a space medicine, obviously the Antarctic experience that has led to evolution of things like telemedicine. But really, a lot of that has kind of also been complemented and sort of came out of the need to be able to communicate with our astronauts up on station. We have things like the random stuff, which people may or not realize, is that in terms of imaging tools that we have on the space station, it's just ultrasound. We don't have, well,
It's
we
just
will get,
ultrasound.
it's just ultrasound.
That's
And so
pretty good.
all your POCUS jockeys
Just
will
get
be.
really good at ultrasound.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, ultrasound can be used for nearly half of the potential things that you might come across in terms of a medical malady in space. However, one of the, it was actually a NASA-funded project that actually added the E to EFAST using ultrasound to diagnose pneumothoraces. And that's something that a lot of ED physicians don't necessarily know. It was actually because of the research, particularly in the space flight environment, that actually led to the E, and a lot of the there's kind of other things that we can kind of glean, protein, crystal growth on in space is more robust than protein crystal growth down here. Why is that relevant? Because our body's got a lot of protein, and in order to be able to make up immunologic agents, other pharmaceutical agents, look at DNA vulnerabilities, and to be able to manipulate things in certain ways, we need to have the ability to grow proteins to a size that we can analyze them. When you grow proteins in space, there's no gravity and there's no convection. So the protein crystals actually are like plump and robust, whereas if you try to do the same down on Earth, they just end up fractured and don't coalesce in the same way. And so crystals are grown and have been grown on the station special lab over the last 25 years, and they then get brought down for analysis, and then that helps to inform our develop of, as I said, cancer fighting agents, immunologics, all these sorts of things. So we kind of need space for doing crazy stuff like that as well.
That's cool, but space also invented the dustbuster.
Yes. Well,
What? You couldn't have
a
things
vacuum.
floating through the
No.
compartments into the components, and so they had to invent a dustbuster. So every time you rip out a dustbuster, Bridgie, don't worry about protein analysis. Thanks, space and space medicine. Beep.
Exactly.
Are you talking about a vacuum when you
Yeah,
say
a little
a
hand vac.
dustbuster, a little one.
A
Little
little one, right.
yeah.
Okay.
I didn't
Because,
know that either.
well, when you're as well, when you're floating around in space, you don't have the same abrasive forces going against your skin, in particular on your feet. And so if you're in space for a while, you end up getting a lot of keratin buildup on your feet. And where we naturally flake off, we might naturally flake off, I don't know, in the shower or as we
That's
kind of
so
rubbing.
gross. Are you
Anyway,
telling me
so
that in
they,
space there's a lot of like dead foot
yep,
skin?
there's a lot of
Oh.
dead skin cells. So they have to clean out the HEPA filters, but they also vacuum their feet to kind of make sure that they don't have any stuff that's floating around.
That's why people
Remote
wear
and
socks.
extreme
environments just aren't the most glamorous sometimes,
And
Space is
well,
supposed to be sexy.
no, it stinks because there's no kind of fresh air, there's no
Oh,
convection.
I didn't think about that either.
Well, the other thing is that just, I suppose it is kind of gross, but it's always the question that gets asked. They recycle their water on the space station, and they actually recycle sweat through the filtration systems. But they also
And
they
urine.
recycle urine. So today's
Do they
coffee's someone
desalinate?
else's tomorrow.
Do they desalinate? Is that like, how do they get the water filtered
Essentially,
out?
they in fact, the filters that have been designed to be small enough to be able to work on the space station to get rid of all the urea and all the other kind of components, to make sure that it's nice and clean. They actually have finessed dialysis filters down on Earth, and also informed solar powered water filtration systems for hostile or disaster areas, because then you can, they're like super filters. So you can actually get kind of access to better water, more potable water, than you otherwise could do. A lot of the time, they're kind of diesel generator kind of activated, but they use sort of solar powered technology as well. So it's just phenomenal. Just even just the recycling of the air and having to maintain, they live at sea level pressure on the
The whole
space
time.
station. Yeah, so 21% oxygen, about 21, 22 degrees Celsius. So short sleeve environment, one atmosphere of pressure, which brings me into, why is diving in hyperbaric relevant to an astronaut? Well, that's because every time they go on a spacewalk, they are going into spacesuits that need to be at a pressure low enough for them to be able to move. So if they were in a sea level spacesuit, it would be like the Michelin man. They wouldn't be able to move
To move.
because the pressure difference between the relative vacuum of space and inside their spacesuit would be too much. They wouldn't be able to move their fingers. They wouldn't be able to do all the work that they need to do. And so we try to make it as low a pressure as possible for them to be able to move. But you can only go so low because even at 100% oxygen, once you get to around about one third suit pressure, you then have the risk of getting hypoxia, just, by Dalton's law. You just don't have enough. And so when it comes to being at sea level and then going to one third pressure, that's like a diver who's been underwater for ages, whose body has equilibrated with it, the environment. So you've become saturated or soaked in nitrogen, so that when you go from high pressure to low pressure, so high pressure is the sea level pressure inside the space station to low pressure inside the spacesuit, they actually can't just do that immediately. They have to undertake about a 4 hour decompression, stage decompression, process in order to prevent what they call supersaturation, which is the phenomenon that causes decompression sickness. So they are at risk of getting decompression sickness or the bends when they go out to do their spacewalk. And you don't want to be stopping a spacewalk mid work because someone's got the bends.
And so
So
on the way out and the way in, they have this, did you say 4 hours they need to adjust?
Just on the way out,
Yep.
because when they are going out, there is the potential for their tissue nitrogen to exceed, substantially exceed the nitrogen level in that they're breathing. And so therefore that creates this kind of pull of nitrogen out of the tissues. And then the change from a high to low pressure means that those nitrogen bubbles can expand and ergo get stuck like
Almost
DCS.
opposite to
Yeah,
diving.
it's
It's like coming
yes.
up too quickly.
Yes. So you have to, well, it's the same as diving. So if you go down deep for a long time, you have to come out slowly as per your decompression tables, have a little deco stop at 6 meters, 3 meters, whatever the situation is. And but what they're doing is they're doing it on the way out the door. And then when they are compressed, they're essentially like a person coming back down to land. So it's also aviators, people that work in hyperbaric chambers that can get risk of what's called altitude decompression sickness. So that is where the relationship is between diving in hyperbaric, which is why I do that clinically because I can get paid to do that, and then the space medicine. So my ultimate dream job would be probably medical director of the Neutral Buoyancy Lab in Houston. But as I said, I'm not American, so
We need one
I can't
here.
do this. Yeah. So what we have to do is try and evolve it. But it brings to the fore some really interesting conundrums, because at the moment on the space station, most of the time they're doing spacewalks to do a little bit of fixing up or put together modules, and they maybe do them only once a month. Whereas with the success of Artemis 2 and the likelihood of going and landing on the moon, certainly within the next, 5 years, the situation will be is that we'll need to have astronauts going out the door and doing moonwalks with much more frequency. The big difference between the Apollo capsules was that they were pressurized at around about 5 PSI. So they were actually depressurized. They kind of had their decompression time from Earth through to the moon. So that was kind of done nice and slowly, and they're breathing 100% oxygen. So when they were going to go from their lander onto the moon's surface in their spacesuits, they didn't really have to have much time at all because they could just pretty much go from a 5.2 PSI spacecraft to like a 4.3 suit, and it's barely any drop. So you're not going to risk that supersaturation. Whereas if we are planning to have a capsule or a lander that's at one atmosphere, it's just not going to work. So there's a lot of, you can't have everyone going for 4 hours in order to reduce the likelihood of getting bent, because that's just going to lose time. So if you're going to have two or three spacewalks or moonwalks every week, you want to be able to get to do that as quickly as possible. So there's a lot of work being done in what's called exploration atmospheres. So how can we live at a lower pressure, like what Apollo did? How can we live at a lower pressure without getting hypoxic, because that would institute a risk of altitude sickness? So you would live in a slightly enriched environment at a lower pressure, which would mean that you'd probably only need around about a 30-minute free breathe on oxygen in order to be able to get out the door. So there's a
Roughly
lot of work that's
4 hours.
being done around that, and hopefully maybe we might be able to participate in some of the other kind of research in that area.
I just want to circle back quickly.
We haven't even got to Poland.
No, I know, I know.
Poland.
There's just there's so much overlap between
Oh.
like you said, dive hyperbaric and space medicine. It's phenomenal how much interlink there is, and then it's amazing how much that actually influences healthcare delivery on Earth. And I mean, I find it ironic, Alicia, because within the extreme environment medicine spaces, a lot of people gauge it from a view or a perspective that we're l the limitations are the problem, and so the limitations are what are actually going to guide what you can do. And so we're actually taking a much lower form of healthcare into extreme environments. But the irony in what we've been talking about is those limitations are actually developing advanced care in standardized medicine. So without the extreme space environments, we wouldn't actually be developing certain aspects of healthcare in the built-up areas without
Yeah,
it.
100%. I mean, gosh, if it wasn't for the fact that telemedicine had been tried and true, particularly with things like space and Antarctic, when it came to COVID, it's like all of before COVID, you didn't do telemedicine. People weren't doing Zoom meetings. They were, but not like with the same veracity. And so you've got people now who can get mental health telehealth, and it's normal, and
It's
so
expected.
it's expected. Yeah. And so, but if we didn't have structures in place in order to be able to kind of go, oh, this is a already developed tool used for extreme environment capabilities, why don't we just use it for the person who can't get into the hospital or see their GP because of pandemic limitations, or because of other limitations, be it agoraphobia or transport, or that they don't have a GP in their little rural town, so they can see a neurologist online,
Especially in Australia, where we have such a diverse and remote environment. Like, we've got people that don't have GPs in their little towns, or they might get them once a month. Like, and
100%.
they need that specialist care or even specialist consultation.
Yeah,
And for
100%.
pediatrics as well. Like, it's just, you don't have those specialties out there, you don't have access to them. It's like, it reduces people's amount of travel, increases their
100%.
access to care.
And
It
look, I think,
increases
that access to care more than anything. And
yeah.
when you were on MDRS, I went to MDRS a couple of years ago. Well, it'd be more than a couple of years ago, far out, time flies. They put us, I mean, part of my preparation for it was a slightly different project to you, but it was orbital mechanics and understanding distances. And they put us on what they called one-way light time for the consults. So if I needed to do any kind of medical consulting with Earth, I mean, I had a battery explode simulation where we had to go and retrieve someone from outside. But that one-way light time meant that my telehealth support was a 4-minute delay because of the positioning of where Mars and Earth were. But
Yes.
at its worst,
It
that
could be
can be a
20 minutes.
40. Yeah, I got told it could be a 42-minute delay. Is it
Yes,
20 or 40? Help me out. 20?
No, well, 20 each way.
Yes, I mean, that's a big deal. You know, hey, Alicia, I got a problem here. 20 minutes. Whoosh.
Yes.
Hey, Alicia, I got a problem here. Yeah, it's 40 minutes for me to hear your reply. Hey, Sonny, what's going on? Well, there's a lot of medical
100%,
planning in between those
100%.
snippets of conversations. And that's the best we've got. That's if there's no, geomagnetic storms, if there's no equipment failures, if there's no solar flares. That's if
100%.
everything works well. I'll get your reply every 20 minutes. That makes consulting at a whole new level, hey? And that's, I mean, your experience with, polar medicine and things like that, no doubt there would be massive delays in the telehealth.
Oh, huge. And look, I think the thing is that at the moment on space station, you would have seen that they had to do a medic the first medical ret you know retrieval or evacuation from the space station in December. Was it December or January? And when it comes to the ability for us to be able to communicate to the space station, there are tiny little, maybe 60-second blackouts, depending on the rotation and satellites, etc. But for the most part, you've got continuous communication. If you wanted to get someone down from the space station, yes, it would cost a lot of money or loss of mission time, etc. But you can drop someone down from the space station within 4 to 6 hours. Okay.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yep,
That's
you could do
incredible.
it. I mean, it would be a very inconvenient thing in the sense that all because of the way that the capsules are seated, you have to bring everyone down. You can't just put
Can't
one
bring them.
person in with a astronaut paramedic and shoot them down. You have to actually decide to bring the whole team down, which is what happened with the most recent or the only evacuation that they've had. They delayed it because there wasn't so much of a rush, and that allowed them to be able to put in logistics and make sure that everything was done in a as safe a way as possible. Counter that to getting someone out of Antarctica, it's like even in the summer, when you want to be able to say, I don't know, you might be able to fly there, but that would be dependent on the person who has the issue being at the base with the airstrip. Yeah. And that's dependent on the fact that the airstrip hasn't been buggered up by some freak cold storm that then has just made it not conducive to be landed on. So you might have to bunny hop people from a base to base to base. Then, if you've got inclement weather and you don't have the ability to be able to do a flight retrieval, then you'd have to get a vessel to come down from Hobart, or maybe the South American peninsula. And then you've got all of that time in order to be able to retrieve people. And so it's because we've got that knowledge on how to look after people, it does help us to sort of translate A, that to general care to people, because if you can't scoop and run, you just have to stay and play. You certainly develop a lot better skills in order to have longer term management of people in a resource poor environment. But when it comes to, say, the astronauts who would then go to the moon, or have the, or hopefully maybe one day, at the moment, the radiation would kill us, so we probably won't go to Mars. But if we went to Mars, then you'd have to have a lot more autonomy. There'd have to be a lot better systems in place to kind of go, look, maybe we can't treat Commander Jack, who's got a significant splenic laceration and a pneumothorax after they fell down into a lava tube. So it's got so many challenges, but then solutions which are being put in place that then have the ability to be able to translate that to remote he care and remote health here.
I think what you just described, though, is something that is not understood enough in the extreme environment medicine space. It's not discussed enough, and we're certainly not preparing the medicos enough for this. Is a lot of us have come or grown up in a hospital or an ambulance environment where the cities are full of resources and the cities are full of equipment. And so when you are moving out into working in remote, rural, expeditionary, extreme environments, you are limited by what you can carry. And that means that if there is, sometimes major incidents, people will die. We forget sometimes that people will die. And, there's been a couple trips that I've prepared for where we have taken body bags with us, and it horrifies people. And it's not actually designed to scare people, but we need to prepare people. If you're going to be operating in the middle of the Amazon, if you're going to be operating in the middle of one of the polar climates, you got to accept that if you get sick or injured, we might not have the resources to stabilize you. Or we might have the
Absolutely.
resources to stabilize you momentarily, which could be, 48, 72, 96 hours. But post that, unfortunately, people will die. And I think we just don't do enough to prepare people for that aspect of remote extreme medicine.
Oh, 100%. Like I do repatriations on commercial airlines for a retrieval company, and that means either taking someone from Australia or New Zealand to back to their home country after they've had some sort of illness or injury here, or what is more relevant to the conversation that you're saying is actually going and bringing people back from somewhere in maybe the middle of nowhere and bringing them back, but on a commercial flight, not a ICU in the sky Learjet, but on a commercial airline where the only real kit that you've got is the kit that you took, which you've tailored to the patient and their circumstance. And that could be that they've had a closed head injury and they've got behavioral problems. Or the one that I did to Norway at, over Christmas was a guy had a residual air fluid pocket from a multiloculated effusion, which then resulted in a pneumothorax. So he was, potentially going to fly needing decompression of his of this loculated air fluid level. When we see these people, we have to have those hard conversations, which is, we are on a commercial airline. I have this XYZ stuff. I have planned for the fact that if you fit, I can do this. If you have a pneumothorax, I can pop your lung. But if you suddenly need inotropes or anything along those lines, it ain't going to happen. And if you arrest, there's not a lot that I can do. And so we have to have those conversations because we can't do everything with the kit that we've got. But as you say, I think those conversations are not necessarily always had with the people who are going to Mount Everest. It's like, it's not designed, you're not designed to go to Mount Everest. Our bodies aren't physiologically designed to do that. If you're a Sherpa and you've been living in that environment and you've acclimatized and you are used to it, it's very different to some person who's coming with their little expedition box to be ticked, who then succumbs because of the environment and the lack of the ability to be able to provide that high level care. So I agree. I think it's an interesting philosophical concept.
It's a sad part of what
Absolutely.
we do.
I don't think it's something we even talk about enough in remote ambulance care. I think I know when I started, we sort of you graduate from your graduate program and then you kind of get your you get kicked out of town and you go to your first ever single officer station.
Oh, God,
And
yeah.
you've been in AMBO for a year and you're 22 and you're like, well, this is going to be great.
Baptism of fire.
That's also where you'll find a lot of junior doctors kicked out to as well, who
And
are
that's
24
that'll
and
be me as well in if this degree doesn't finish me before I finish it. But I don't think it is something we talk about because I know and you see it, you're going out to this remote spot, you always say like you've got the consult line, You have your clinical practice manual. You have all these backup options. But realistically, sometimes you don't have those backup options. And sometimes there isn't a lot that you can do for the things that you're going to, because you will go to something on your own. You will have a point where you can't get into, comms with anyone. Your radio's not working. Your iPad's dead, or you left it behind. There will be times where you have to rely on your own knowledge and, I guess, your behavioral patterns to get through a situation. And it's not always going to be a happy outcome. It's not always, you're not always going to be able to fix it.
And
And I
certainly, I think,
think we prepare each other for that.
And I think that unfortunately, what tends to happen is because it's not necessarily talked about, then those sorts of experiences occur, and the person to whom it's occurred to, particularly if you're more junior, then it kind of goes, well, it was clearly a me issue. You know, it was clearly a me issue, and that can completely destroy that individual's career. Whereas they might have done the most phenomenal work under a really challenging situation that was never going to end up in a good outcome. And but they will, it doesn't, you know, most people are probably type A personalities anyway, who end up with the confidence enough to be able to put themselves in those situations. And it can completely disable people and ruin careers.
It very much exposes us to moral injury when we don't prepare. And even if preparation is just like that psychological familiarization with what an outcome could possibly be, which is a lot of what I think our preparation is for some of those remote environments, it is just the conversations and that psychological familiarization that can protect us from that moral injury. Enough sometimes that it can make a huge difference between how you deal with whatever that situation is going forward in your practice, and whether you take that forward and learn, or whether it does, stop you from continuing on in your
The
chosen.
irony is, I think it's because it's uncomfortable to talk about
That's
patients
true,
dying.
yeah.
And I mean, you know, two lifetimes ago when I was still a soldier, you know, when we went to Iraq, half of the issues that actually occurred were because people actually hadn't expected to be around death or destruction. You know, people trying to kill us were trying to kill them. You know, it's how on earth we didn't have those conversations to move into a war zone, I will never fully understand. I think things are much better now. But it's because it's uncomfortable. And we tend to avoid those things. And I think if we acknowledge them and we talk about them more, then you can actually achieve a much higher capability and a much better response to these incidents, or a much quicker healing period. Because, like, you know, Alyssa was saying, you know, there's a blame game, or, you know, is it me? I think we just need to be a lot more comfortable with those things, because no matter what the environment is, you know, whether it be space, whether it be diving, whether it be deserts, whether it be sitting in a tin can flying at 800 kilometers an hour, which you seem to love, Alyssa, there's always going to be limitations that are going to challenge us. And so understanding those limitations is kind of key, or, you know, that's what should give us the most clarity into the role that we're doing. And it's hey, you know, we haven't even talked about Poland.
No, that's right. I was just going to say, all of that comes down to having good mentors, though, as well. You know,
True, true.
having good mentors and teachers and those people who are happy to have those conversations. And so particularly, I think the community of extreme environment clinicians, I think people, we're like a little hive that are just crazy enough to try and do silly things like go and do medicine where other people don't. But that's what makes us cool. However, I think that it's just about kind of it's about having that platform and having those mentors and the conversations. So anyway, that's an aside. All right,
That
Poland.
that's Dr. Alicia Tucker. She's at UTAS, and she's also at a hospital in Hobart. If you want a clinical mentor, she can't say no. All right. Sorry, Poland, go.
Well, I wasn't all pierogies, if that's what you want to hear. Although we
Were
did,
there pierogies?
yeah, there were pierogies. So look, I mean, further to kind of all of the stuff that we've even sort of talked about. So obviously went to do the Martian analog at the Mars Desert Research Station. And the I don't know how it even came about. I saw that there was I did a bit of research into analogs a few years ago when we were looking at analog facilities around the world and whether or not we could try and create one here in Australia. And the Mars Society were kind of trying to build one out in the desert in Arakoola, I think, in South Australia. Anyway, we also are turning our old hyperbaric chamber into a spacecraft analog. So it's in that sort of, it's been designed, it's just got to be executed. And what we plan to do there is to have a spacecraft like you're traveling from here to Mars or the moon or whatever it is, and have longer term isolated studies on individuals who are even within a much smaller environment without the ability to go outside, like what happens at the MDRS. You still have the potential to be able to go on to the Martian surface. But this is more like a space capsule that A, we can also depressurize, so have the ability to be able to maybe have people living at an exploration atmosphere. So I was kind of interested in what it would be like to be more in that super confined situation. So I came across Lunaris, which is it's a purpose-built facility in northwest Poland in a place called Piwa. And the company directors are prior associates with ESA, and they're actually architects, and they design space architecture. And so, but they're also really interested in research and particularly things like human factors research. And they, I know they came across some. I think they designed the original structure and then decided that where it was, they probably needed a more dedicated area. So they had an entrepreneur who acquired a essentially a Cold War Soviet bunker that has now been, with the wall coming down. Those things are kind of are available, and it's at a little small airbase, and so that has been converted in addition to like a pinwheel of shipping containers with a central dome, inflated dome, and all of that is interconnected and fully isolatable from the outside world. So they offer either a participant or research opportunities for other people to have a number of missions per year, and a mission is
Oh God,
essentially.
there's snow at it. Was it cold?
Yeah, no, there was snow.
Sorry,
Did you just look it up?
I just looked up the picture and there's just ice everywhere.
Yeah, so it was
I'm
minus
stuck on the fact
18
it's a
degrees.
Cold War.
Yeah, no, it's
Like,
super
how does
cool.
one
Oh my
acquire
God,
one
they're
of
so
those?
cool. It's really cool. It's got like covered in
Yeah.
grass and that kind of stuff as well. So anyway, so it was minus 18 degrees when I went in.
Inside?
No, outside.
Oh, I was
So
about to say, oh.
yeah, so minus 18 degrees outside in the cold. So the actual facility itself has like a central hub. So sort of the heart of the habitat is a domed area, which is around about I reckon it's probably 8 by 8 kind of meters, like just or well probably an 8 meter diameter anyway. And then it's actually got quite a high ceiling because it comes up to a dome, which is probably 6 meters high. So quite a nice kind of heart. And then there's a sleeping area, so your bunks. There is a operations room. There is a pod which is for your kitchen and dining. There's a hygiene pod. There's an operations workshop. And then there is an airlock that takes you into a dedicated EVA or space or moonwalk area, which is where they have set up a lunar environment, with kind of dirt that's kind of a bit like lunar regolith. And there's a radiation shelter down one end. There is sort of some solar panels, communication towers, all that kind of thing. And all of that is within this old bunker. So it's completely black.
So it's completely dark.
It's completely dark. So you can turn a light on if you want to simulate that you're on the near side of the moon and you're getting the sun. But we elected to land our spacecraft on the kind of the far western side, just almost to the far side of the moon, because that would mean that we were always in the dark, which would mean that when we were doing spacewalks, we were always in the dark, which just elevated that level of reality, because you could only see whatever your lights were in front of you, which is kind of how you imagine it would be if you were on the far side of the moon without any ambient light. So there was a crew of seven of us. I was chosen as the commander. I think probably because I've got some sort of leadership exposure in the past. And our age range was 49 down to 19.
Wow.
The 19-year-old was probably one of the youngest that they've ever had, because we're supposed to represent kind of a group of astronauts. So all the people had like a STEM background, or a background of the kind of character that you would expect to undertake lunar missions, etc. That we all had to be established in some way or working within the field that you are bringing that skill to the mission. However, we could also bring our own research, and then otherwise there was research being done on us from a behavioral health and also some other more sort of tangible research, such as like growing plants and the technical aspects of living and working in space. So we have a limited amount of resources. So we had 2,000 liters of water for the seven of us for a 14-day period, and that had to be used also to generate grey water for flushing the one toilet, which is, better than a porta potty, but still seven people all wanting to go to the toilet
Can I ask a question real quick? When you flush the toilet at MDRS, the whole habitat shook. So you knew exactly what people were doing when they were doing it.
Well,
What was it?
when I went to the MDRS, the toilet was broken,
What
and
did they go to
so
space?
we had to have a port-a-loo,
Oh no.
which we called the TARDIS.
The TARDIS.
And the TARDIS, we had nine of us for a fortnight using the one port-a-loo. And the only good thing is they're all clinical, and so we had to take it in turns to be the stool distribution person and use the poo stick to do the stool distribution. So you could tell what everybody had been eating because all of it was dehydrated food. So there's a lot of corn, a lot of corn. As an aside, however, when it came to the loo here, it was better isolated. However, you heard the grey water pump.
Right.
So yeah, the grey water pump would go off.
Still no privacy.
Still no privacy, and also grey water stinks as well anyway. So you've got a pretty stale environment with a grey water flushing system. Anyway, that's an aside. We also had some Fresh, but mostly non-perishable items, so cans and the like. But we didn't just have dehydrated food like we did at the MDRS. But we weren't allowed to have any caffeine, so there was no caffeine. There was this kind of oat, what we call foffy, fake coffee, so oat drink. There was no caffeine, no sugar, which is, starts to get interesting when you've got no caffeine
I
and no
don't think
sugar.
I'm going to survive in space.
No, and then no alcohol, which is fine. You can do
Oh,
without
that's
that. But the caffeine and
the
the
caffeine
sugar.
and the sugar that would really, yeah.
And then when you're rostered from 7 in the morning to about 10 p.m. at night, and we had various things that we had to do. So whether or not that's certain responsibilities to do with cleaning, cooking, all of those sorts of aspects, as well as whatever role requirements there were. So we had to, myself and the executive officer had to be kind of liaison with mission control and make sure that we were looking after all of the resources, controlling all of the interpersonal interactions, etc. I must say we had a reasonably functional crew. I won't go beyond that because it could go beyond this and to the individuals. However, I think that my experience from what people had said in the past, like all it takes is just one or two people to just completely destroy the feng shui of a group. So if you're not pulling your weight, if you're using all the resources, it's very easy to then cause factions. And so part of what they are doing is actually having a look about how A, the crew interacts with themselves, how they manage, how people like the commanders and the XOs manage issues that might arise, etc. And then otherwise, every second day we were going out and doing a moonwalk, and that would mean two astronauts going out in like. They were still kind of fake, as you would appreciate with the MDRS experience, Sunny. They were still fake, but they felt very real. You had particularly the helmets have lights, life support monitoring systems in them. So if you don't have enough air movement, that you can actually end up with a CO2 buildup, and that can cause headaches and issues. And we had all these kind of monitoring systems associated, which then mission control could manipulate as well. And so when we would go out, we would have certain objectives we'd have to try and achieve. And of course, sometimes you might run into problems. It could be all of a sudden there's a radiation surge, or it could be that someone has a puncture in their spacesuit, and so you simulate that by suit pressures going down. So you have mission control who are overarching. They're the only people that we interacted with for a whole fortnight. So no social media, no internet, no connection, nothing.
No social
And
media, no internet, no sugar, no caffeine. Half of the people listening have just gone, nope.
I know, just gone kind of like, why are you doing this with six other people that you've never
Was
met
about to say
before
six other strangers
and
from
one probably
different
chews with their
countries.
mouth open.
Yeah. And you've
Who
got
said dehydrated food with their mouth open?
exactly. So you've got all of these factors, and people are like, why did you do this? But then with the EVAs, what we would do is we'd have two people outside. And then we'd have three people as part of HABCOM, so the Habitat Comms. And so you'd have a HABCOM leader, the support to the leader, and then you have a safety officer. And then the other two people that were residual in our group often did a lot of support and helping with putting their suits on and the like. But it was a really good demonstration of how important communication is, resource, using your protocols, but being flexible enough to kind of have to switch between things, flip through emergency scenarios, and just, have that ability to be able to say if mission control is not available, all of a sudden, mission control are not available. There's some sort of issue that's going on in the habitat because there's been a big decompression issue, and you've got astronauts out on the moon. And they can't get in contact with anyone. And it's kind of, so what do? They can't just rush back in. They also have to go through an airlock, decompression, or recompression, decontamination, all of these kind of factors. So it was a really fascinating experience to be able to apply life as an astronaut, and the challenges of resource, the challenges of lack of communication, not being able to contact family, all of those sorts of things. I had a cold while I was there. A few
Oh
people had a
no.
cold. Someone brought a cold in. And so you kind of have to factor those sorts of things where you feel like shit.
Ask the person that you put the cold in. I mean, what time?
No, exactly.
Yeah.
And so yeah, it's lots of, and it's those kind of little wins that you have to try and go in. And as a commander, I've been a leader of various kind of flash groups, and where you've got people who you don't work with, and you've got strategies on how to manage individuals, and particularly to coordinate a resource or be able to, have a shared mental model that you're all working towards the same goal to in order to help the individual. But very different to 24/7 trying to manage individuals who you've never come across that you don't want to piss off. Because then that can lead to mutiny and be a really bad thing for everyone. Hey, so
Sweet.
that was pretty cool. But we came out and the Iran war started. And so we went in and it was minus 18 degrees. Everything was all fine. And then all of a sudden we've got a war.
Wow.
So
Did that
that
affect
was really
you guys getting
bizarre.
home?
It didn't affect me getting home because I had flights that were routed through London and then Singapore, Sydney. But a couple of so we our astronauts, the 19-year-old is an Indian lad and he lives in Mumbai. He 100% earned his stripes to be there. He does drone technology development for the Indian military.
Wow.
Just one of those people. And then we had a veterinarian from the US,
Wow.
originally Costa Rican, and we had a lass who is Chinese who is an architect. And she's at school in Cambridge. And so she was doing particularly looking at living designs in space. We had a guy who's a psychologist who works who's from Germany. We had a guy who was I suppose kind of neuroscience as well, and he was from Sweden. So, and then, myself from Australia, and then there was another Australian Vietnamese lass who's a pharmacist. So, a real kind of mix match of cultures, a real mix match of disciplines, and a real diversity of age, three men, four women. So it's just really interesting the kind of group that they put together. Why they kind of do all of this sort of stuff is because when you have astronauts who are government-trained astronauts, they are often trained together. They're often really like gelled as a team. You see Artemis 2, those four have been hanging out together and working together, problem-solving together, losing, themselves together, hurting together, challenging each other. They all are, and they're like the ultimate team. But if we want to go and live on the moon, or if we want to have groups of people up at the space station, because we're getting commercial space stations where the average Joe can go, right? And then you put a whole bunch of people who haven't been vetted to have the right stuff. They don't have the same psychological robustness. you might end up, dare I say it, with the Korean person who had to be taken out of an Antarctic station in the last few days because they were wielding a knife. You don't want
I
that sort
hadn't
of a
heard about that.
situation. Yeah, you don't want to be having that sort of a situation occurring in space. So,
No.
with it's having the opportunity to have these analog facilities on Earth allows us to be able to use them as a testing ground, not only for research that might then go up to space, so that we can tweak things so that they're not taking up more space time than they need to be, but also so that we can have a look at what these more dynamic groups of people behave like. And that's also got applications to other remote and extreme environments as well. We use Antarctica like an analog. We use submarines as an analog, saturation diving, wintered out remote areas in Canada and all those kind of places. So when you put a whole bunch of people together in a place that they can't get out of, someone's going to scratch the eyeballs out of someone else. So we just, how do we manage that? How do we identify things and intervene, and what's the best way to intervene before it gets to be too much of a
It's
problem?
not even behavioral issues though. I mean, it's like Everest, 50 years ago, it was only the fittest, best climbers, could enter that area. And now you've got Everest ER that's treating chest pain and respiratory conditions and ocular problems because if you've got money, you can
100%.
go. The space stations for the private sector are going to be full of medical complications that have just never
100%.
existed in space. But
Yeah. Oh, look, that's a perfect segue to one of the big things I'm really interested in is the commercial side of things. So, I do the polar expedition tourist ships to
yeah, I
the
think
north and south.
you called them polar ships, which, I mean, it sounded like one word, polar
Yeah,
ship. Like, is this like a
polar
scholarship in
ships.
the
It's a
polar
polar
regions or
ship.
whatever?
Yeah, no. So I work for Clark Expeditions, and they have their expedition cruises that go to the Arctic and the Antarctic, and that's an interesting challenge as a clinician because you have a bit like what you were saying. You've got these before where we were talking about risk and potential for dying and all this kind of stuff. You've got all these people who have the money to be able to go to these playgrounds where they couldn't otherwise have access to them, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they have health. But they're willing to take that risk, or at least give you that risk to manage, in order to be able to go and see the penguins and the polar bears or wherever that whatever tickles their fancy. And space is no different. If we have a look at the number of people that have gone to space ever, it's around about sort of 720 people now. Okay, space meaning anything above 100 kilometers above the Earth, the Kármán line. If you have a look at the number of people who've gone into space in the last 5 years, that's 20% of all the people that have gone to space. So over a 65 years, 750 people or 720 people, and 20% of those have gone to space in the last 5 years. And that is because of commercial space flight. So yes, SpaceX making it more readily accessible for them to be able to transfer people that are part of government agencies. But private astronaut missions like the Axiom missions, Polaris Dawn, the FRAM-2 polar orbiting mission, then you've got all the suborbital players, so Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic. And so you've got a population that has gone from a median age of 30, test pilots, fighting fit, well-vetted, right stuff individuals, to an age range of 18 to 90 with various levels of medical maladies that have to be managed and optimized in order to be able to go to space. However, they want to go to space. So you have to, how can we actually get these people to space safely? and land the medical legal side of things onto them. So when it comes to here on Earth, we have fitness to fly, fitness to dive, that we do. Well, I do
Oh,
both of these.
dive. I thought you said fitness to
Dive.
die. You said
Fitness to
fitness. Okay.
dive, yes. So I'd like to make sure that you're fit enough to succumb.
Succumb
You
to
know, so this is I've
Right.
just yeah, this is my new hat. And so but when we go to space, our flight surgeons make sure that we've got fit astronauts, yeah. And we have flight surgeons that work for private astronaut companies, or commercial space flight companies such as Virgin, Blue Origin, SpaceX, Vast Industries, Axiom, yeah. And when we look at the trajectory and the type of craft that is being built, Virgin have stood back for a couple of years because they're developing what's called the Delta class spaceship. And that will be able, they will be able to fly 2 or 3 times a week, and they'll have multiple aircraft. They will be able to fly 6 passengers into a suborbital flight, which will be a 2 or 3 hour experience, where they take off slung under what's called the mothership, which is essentially 2 747 type aircrafts that are connected by sort of a central wing under which is slung the spacecraft that acts as a kind of a. It's like the hand holding the paper airplane. It helps to launch the spacecraft once they reach a certain height. That spacecraft then goes up into space, does a lovely parabola, 7 or 8 minutes, maybe maximum of microgravity, get out, fly around the cabin. There's no air hostess, there's no meal option. You just have to stay in there. There's 2 pilots, no air hostess, 6 passengers. Then they come down to land like a normal aircraft. From the end of this year, they are potentially flying up to 1,600 people a year. And that's out of one spaceport alone. So what Virgin have done is Virgin Galactic have actually asked aviation medical examiners from around the world, including myself, whereby we have undertaken some training to support doing these kind of at least gathering the data and getting the information for the Virgin Galactic flight surgeons to do final kind of ticks in the box. But we are, look, that's just one industry, let
Yeah.
alone if you are, if once we deorbit the space station, it's going to be a commercial space station. And that is going to be a place where people will be able to go up. You know, I'm going to just go to the space station for a couple of weeks. Maybe my kids might go and tend bar on space station instead of having a year in Europe. You know, what is the physiologic effects going to be in the short term, in the long term? What is the issues in terms of radiation? You know, we haven't even touched on radiation, and that's a huge topic in itself. And so we know that astronauts don't fare well to those that change of environment, particularly microgravity affecting your vestibular system, your cardiovascular system, the offloading causing bone and muscle atrophy and degradation, as well as all of the fluid dynamics that kind of end up changing and influencing even diagnostic stuff. You can't just hang a bag of saline in space because A, the little space, the little fluid bubble at the top of a normal bag of saline is then integrated. You've just got a bag of bubbles, yeah.
Wonderful.
You've got
That's going to really work
no,
out.
yeah, you've got no gravity in order to be able to put that fluid into someone. So you're going to have some form of pump set, yeah. However, if you have a pump set, that's mass and volume and energy that, you know, someone's got to get up there. Or you can maybe just, you know, do the old pumping it through your hand. But then you then go to the point where it's like, okay, well, giving a bag of saline is fine. What happens if you have some sort of an injury, or they have a cardiac arrest? You see all this footage of people doing CPR in the space station and how you can do it in microgravity. I kind of go, we're back at that conversation. Why are you doing CPR?
What are we doing
What is
after?
your destination here?
Oh, I've got some controversial questions for you, and that's one of them,
Yeah.
Alicia. You just stole it from me because
Ha.
we've run out of time. We've got to talk about radiation another one because I mean this we could talk for ages. But are you ready for some controversial questions?
Sure.
These are going to be
Controversial
quoted
rapid
to
fire.
Dr. Alicia Tucker for UTAS Hobart Hospital. No, I'm joking. All
And
righty, here we
held
go.
against me
So,
before the war.
the private participants who are jetting into space for 7 minutes,
Yep.
defined as astronauts,
Yes.
or are they stealing a professional title from people who worked a decade for
Yes. Well, originally they were called space flight
She said, yes, we'll
participants.
move on. Okay, great. I'm joking.
But now, and they used to, the FAA and the powers that be used to keep an honor roll of anyone who'd been flown above 100 kilometers above the Earth, the Kármán line.
The Kármán line.
In the US, that has been rationed down to 80 kilometers
Controversially.
just because they can. They have so many people that they actually stopped giving out commercial astronaut wings because so many people were achieving commercial astronaut status. They're still called commercial astronauts. However, they no longer keep a list, or it's no longer a published list because there
That's
are
so
so many people on it.
sad.
And
Ugh.
so you have to
Is
be,
it so sad?
you have, you're either a career astronaut or a private astronaut. So the private astronauts are people who've been really trained up to then undertake a proper mission. And then you've got space flight participants or commercial astronauts who kind of
They
fall
should
under
be
that
called
umbrella.
space tourists.
Like Katie
Yeah.
Camp.
Yes,
Yeah.
exactly. Thank you. All right, you ready
Yes.
for number? So, hold on.
Yeah.
So the answer to that was yes, they are. You've just upset like half the planet. That's great.
I don't agree
yeah.
with
In the
it.
most extreme environments, is there a place for CPR defib or advanced airways?
I kind of go, no, not
Yeah,
necessarily.
this is totally
I
yes, no
think,
answers, so we can just
yeah,
pull what we want out of it.
I think if you've got something whereby you need an, you've had some form of R&T phenomena and you've got a shockable rhythm and it is going to be something that is a able to be able to achieve rapid ROSC and conscious levels and all those kind of things. I think that that's very reasonable. And maybe to sustain CPR, you know, like the big electric shock or something along those lines, that will allow you to be able to get that person back very quickly. I think that that is a good reason. I think advanced airway stuff in the context of being able to provide an intervention that is life-saving. But maybe the airway management is needed only temporarily, either from a humanitarian anaesthetic perspective or from a reversible illness and management perspective. Otherwise, if you're doing CPR or someone's got a respiratory arrest and you're in the middle of nowhere, you have, I would have a very short period of time through which I will be putting those any extra resources to save someone if you have been able to risk assess that this is not a reversible problem, this is not quickly managed, and the resources in order to provide ongoing advanced life support for this person to get from A to where they would otherwise be able to survive whatever it is. If that is if that is impossible, then they're just decisions that you have to make.
That's if you've even got it.
That's if you even got
Because
it. Yeah, you've
the
even got the
question.
thing.
The questions here, are you
If
even
you
going to carry an
no.
advanced airway? But okay,
No.
all right, last one, last
I
one.
would care I tend to carry basic airway adjuncts. And I will carry an LMA when I'm on, say, like these commercial flights or some such. But I wouldn't ever bother about, you know, having a bag, like a ETT and a laryngoscope and all that kind of stuff.
Oh,
You
these are the
know,
things that come up. You see
yeah.
people getting criticized for practicing CPR and, you know, the death zone in the mountains. But anyway,
Yeah.
all right, last one. And this is something you said at the start.
Huh. Oh
Are
no.
we emphasizing evacuation as fast as possible or as comfortable as possible?
Oh, look, evacuation. I'm not quite sure if you're talking about your bowels or medical evacuation, because we kind of did go there as well. Anyway, so I,
We did go there. We also went to feet.
yeah,
Feet. We went to
feet.
feet.
Keratinized feet.
Skin feet.
I think that's a big challenge anyway. I think when it comes to evacuation and getting someone from wherever you are to where they should be, I think that there is sometimes a role for the old scoop and run, but only if that extrication period or the transportation period is quite short. If there is a risk that you'll need to do any intervention like intubation, etc., you're always better to do it where you've got a bigger space, so not in the old tin cigar. So I would always stay and manage any anticipated risk, and if that meant intubating a psychotic person before putting them into the tin cigar, that's what I would do, even if that took me a bit more time. If it took me longer to, say, get to a recompression chamber because I was wanting to make sure that they were optimized for that, I would take that time. It's as with everything that we do, particularly in the extreme environment, it's about that balance of anticipated risk, real risk. How can I mitigate the risk? How is that going to impact on the person's trajectory and their ultimate outcome? And is me spending an extra 15 minutes managing that risk actually probably that's going to end up with a much better outcome for the individual at the end of the day? So there you go.
I'm all about comfort. Bridgie, I tried to get her controversial. She's just too clever. She can just
Ah,
professionalize anything. Goodness me.
oh, damn it.
Folks,
Won't do it
that's
to our level.
Folks, that's Poddex Medicine with Dr. Alicia, Bridgie and Sunny. If you like what you heard, you can find us on the Academy website. And if you want to get in touch with Alyssa, Bridgie or myself, please reach out to the Academy, www.academyxmedicine.com.au. We're done.